Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! We talk with Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney, who wins big despite predictions her new district would not support her. The new party talks about its future, and a conversation with former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders from the beginning.
I said, you didn't know what you was getting when you asked me to be your health director. I said, but you know what you're getting now. And he said, yes, I do. I want you to do for the nation what you've done for Arkansas.
To the end.
I told him, I said, well, I won't resign. And so an hour later, the president calls me, telling me that, well, Joycelyn, we can't have any more of this, and I'm just sorry. We just can't. I said, Mr. President, do you know what I said? He said, yes, they told me. I said, but hey, do you know exactly what I said? He said, I understand. They got it. They told me what you said. He said, we just can't have any more of this, and I'm just sorry. If just get your resignation on Panetta's desk by 2:30. And so I just said, well, thank you, Mr. President. What else could I say?
Have you ever spoken to President Clinton again?
No.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Former White House advisor Pierre Salinger today cast aside U.S. denials and stood by his charge that a U.S. Navy missile accidentally shot down the TWA jumbo jet, which crashed off New York in July. Salinger said he'd been given a document in Paris by an agent of the U.S. Secret Service, which said the airliner, flying too low and behind schedule, had entered an area where the U.S. Navy was staging missile tests. He said, the paper that I have read is very, very strong proof that a missile did have a part in bringing down the plane. Salinger, who initially made his allegations to airline officials attending a meeting in the French Mediterranean resort of Cannes, told reporters he was not surprised by the denials and offered to show the FBI his three-month-old document, which he said he had been given 5 weeks ago. He suggested the evidence in his possession may have been withheld to avoid embarrassing President Bill Clinton before Tuesday's presidential election. A group of Reform Party members in Dallas wants to wrench control of the party from founder Ross Perot. The group has filed a request with the Federal Election Commission seeking recognition as the party's national governing body. The designation could help determine who controls the party's money, including federal dollars the party expects to receive in the next presidential election. Because Perot got 8.5% of the vote in Tuesday's election, the party can get federal financing in 2000. Most of the breakaway faction's membership consists of supporters of one-time Perot rival Richard Lamb. The final election night numbers are in for television networks, and they're about as bad as they were for Bob Dole. ABC, CBS, and NBC had a combined 24 rating and 39 share for their election coverage from 7 to 11 on Tuesday night. This according to the Nielsen Media Research figures released on Thursday. A rating points represents 970,000 households, or 1% of the nation's estimated 97 million TV homes. The share is the percentage of TV sets in use and tuned to a show during a specified time period. And spend more, win more. For congressional contenders, it was a rule to live by this year. 9 of 10 candidates who were able to follow it walked away victorious. The large house freshman class was living proof. The better fundraisers managed to build moats around once vulnerable campaign castles, while the few who lagged in dollars ultimately fell to better finance challengers. The police department in Indianapolis punished 7 officers for allegedly participating in a drunken melee involving racial slurs, lewd remarks to women, and attacks on 2 men who tried to intervene. 2 officers will be fired, 2 suspended, and 3 demoted, this according to the acting police chief. And 3 days after Election Day, they still don't know who's going to be the new junior senator from Oregon, and they won't until next week at the earliest. Election officials in California and Oregon were still counting absentee ballots Thursday, leaving 1 Senate and 3 House races unsettled. In Oregon, the Senate contest and 1 House race remained up in the air, with nearly 500,000 absentee ballots still being counted. 2 House races in California also hung in the balance. While those races remain too close to call, the outcomes won't affect continued Republican control of the House and the Senate. A federal judge has ordered ABC to give Whitewater prosecutors the tape of its interview with Susan McDougal. McDougal was a Whitewater partner with the Clintons. In issuing the ruling, the judge denied the network's claim of journalist privilege. ABC now has 10 days to turn over the outtakes from the August 30th Primetime Live interview. In the interview, McDougal said she was tempted to tell Whitewater prosecutors whatever they wanted to hear in exchange for a lighter sentence. Motor voter legislation got millions of people registered around the country, but bureaucratic foul-ups and voter confusion kept some of them from the polls. And the AFL had a lot at stake on Election Day, having based its revival largely on a $35 million political campaign. But Republicans retained control of the House despite Labor's best efforts, and many questions what Union Chief John Sweeney promised would be the biggest political comeback in history. And finally, Mario Savio, a leader of the free speech movement, which jolted the University of California during the 1960s, died in a California hospital on Wednesday. Savio had been in a coma since being admitted last Saturday to the hospital. Savio's wife, brother, and son were among family members at his bedside when he died Wednesday afternoon. Savio had lived in California. He became well-known in 1964 when he urged fellow students at the University of California, Berkeley, to shut down the campus to protest a ban on political activity on campus. The ban came at a time when student activists were trying to recruit others into the civil rights movement. The free speech movement sparked years of upheavals on U.S. campuses, later to be torn by Vietnam War protests.
My name is Mario Savio. I'm chairman of University Friends of SNCC. I've been one of the people who have been meeting with the deans here to see if we can have freedom of speech at the University of California.
Are you a student?
Yes, I am. A junior in philosophy.
Yes, you were.
Mario, how old are you?
I am. 21.
Who is arrested and why?
All right, now.
Is he a student?
We can't tell who's arrested because he refused to give his identification. I'd like to explain that. I'll tell you why he was arrested, in my opinion. He happens to be a person quite outspoken in his disagreement with what the administration does. They happen to pick upon those people who are the most outspoken. You know, there's a story told, it appears one of the tales that Herodotus tells in his stories about the Persian Wars. Said it was this, you know. Person wanted to know, how can we take over a particular city or country in the most effective way? And the following parable was told. Have you ever seen a wheat field? You see how there are some stalks of wheat that stand up above the others? It's very simple. Don't cut them all down. Just cut the ones that stick up the highest. And you've won. Well, that's precisely what they did. They're smart to that extent at any rate. That's why they arrested them.
Mario Savio. His most famous moment came in 1964 when police arrested activist Jack Weinberg for handing out leaflets on the Berkeley campus and put him in a police car. Scores of students sat down around the car, refusing to move for 32 hours. Savio was one of the students who climbed on top of the car and delivered a speech that electrified the crowd. After weeks of marches, sit-ins, and a strike, the university gave way and lifted the ban on political activity. In recent years, Savio has spoken out publicly on a variety of social issues, opposing the initiative passed by California voters this week to dismantle many state affirmative action programs. Again, Mario Savio has died in California. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Cynthia McKinney scored an important and historic victory in Tuesday's election. Numerous pundits had predicted that the outspoken and progressive black congressmember from Georgia would not prevail in a new majority white district after the Supreme Court ruled that her previously majority black district had been racially gerrymandered. Her victory was truly inspiring for many. Her district had been two-thirds black and is now two-thirds white. She joins us now on the phone from Georgia. Welcome, Congressman McKinney. Congressmember McKinney.
Good morning.
Well, how did you do it?
We worked hard, and we had a good message, and we also had a good track record that people were familiar with. But, you know, the pundits have always underestimated the power of the people, because basically what you have are the pundits who are actually in the employ of status quo establishment-type figures, and so they speak the establishment status quo line. So we can't really expect anything other than for them to underestimate the power of a progressive, unabashedly progressive African-American liberal female who is willing to take a stand when it's most uncomfortable to do so.
Talk about the issues that you ran on against John Mitnick, the Republican.
Basically, I ran on the issues that had been presented to us as in the 103rd and 104th Congress, that the record of our support for women, family and medical leave, raising the minimum wage, the crime bill, which, you know, I was there and I lobbied on behalf of the administration with my colleagues to make sure that we had enough votes to pass the crime bill, an important piece of legislation. And I watched in November of 1994 as my colleagues lost, and many of them lost because of the passage of the crime bill. Also, the president's deficit reduction package, the state of the economy. We campaigned on the track record of the Democratic administration of the country, and also particular things that I had done while being a member of Congress that put my constituents first.
What do you think this says to critics of the Supreme Court who say that this is racially inspired, perhaps racist, their whole attack on black Congress members and changing their districts, despite the fact that many white districts have as oddly shaped areas?
Well, you know, shape is the most absurd criterion for judging a district that I have ever even conceived of. And with the impact of the new computer technology, districts would be drawn with irregular shape no matter what the competing forces were that saw their creation. And there are, let me tell you, many, many competing forces. It is never primarily race or predominantly race as a factor. And so the Supreme Court decision was one that I believe demonstrated their total ignorance of the whole redistricting process, Sandra Day O'Connor notwithstanding. But there will be a tremendous amount of pressure for people to conclude that minority districts are no longer necessary because people like me won elections. Well, that's not the case. And in fact, the Georgia case is before the Supreme Court again this session on appeal, and the plaintiff attorney intends to use the fact that I won and Sanford Bishop won as reasons for them having done the right thing. But look at how we were able to present ourselves in these new districts. The voters of the old 11th District of Georgia lifted me up on their shoulders and gave me an opportunity to make for them a better America, a better community. And we began to do that. Because we were able to do that with such success and with such enthusiasm and passion and vigor, other people had the opportunity to get to know me. And then because they were able to get to know me, I was able to get the necessary endorsements, the national support, had the name recognition, and all of the powers of incumbency that also help in this kind of a new and pioneering situation. Fortunately, I didn't shy away and stood for re-election, and we were able to convince the voters of the new 4th District that this was an opportunity worth seizing. And I am humbled by the fact that the voters of the new 4th District did seize the opportunity. But districts are not drawn for elected officials. Districts are drawn for people. And so what about the people who are left behind in the old 11th District? Those people whose problems have not yet been completely solved, and they still live in abject poverty without running water in their homes. They're still dying from environmental contamination. They're still living in unhealthy and unsafe living conditions. What about those people now as they take a giant leap backwards into the way, an era really the way it used to be. But they are empowered now because of the representation that I've been able to provide for them. They understand the difference between electing a representative and having representation. And so I believe that you're going to see much more vigorous activity on the part of those voters, and hopefully their voices will not be lost in the dismantling of the old 11th District.
Congressmember McKinney, one of the things you're most known for in Congress is you're championing the Arms Code of Conduct. Now, you're one half of the team. The other half is retiring Senator from Oregon, Mark Hatfield. With him leaving, what does this mean, and what are your plans? Each year you've put it forward saying that you shouldn't be selling, the U.S. government shouldn't be selling weapons to dictators. Each year you put it forward, it gets more votes, but it hasn't passed yet.
That's correct. And we will find a Senate sponsor, and we've got lots of potential Senate sponsors. So because we've lost Senator Hatfield does not mean that we have lost the momentum associated with this bill. We will reintroduce it. We will work the committee process. We will bring it to the floor for another vote, and hopefully we'll be able to, it's just common sense, you know? And one of the things that I've learned up in Washington in politics is that it's the common sense things that are the most difficult to pass, to prevail. And so we're just going to have to hunker down and lobby and work a little bit harder than those arms manufacturers, because they've got an awful lot of money and they've got an awful lot of influence and an awful lot of power. But the bottom line is that the America that we know and love and want to be projected abroad is not the America that sells arms to dictators.
Cynthia McKinney, it seems that one of the things that Harvey Gantt didn't do quite as much as you did is in Harvey Gantt's campaign against the Republican incumbent, Jesse Helms, which he lost, a number of activists were saying they found this time that Washington handled his campaign, Washington insiders, and really didn't want that much grassroots activity, although certainly there were a lot of grassroots activists there. There wasn't a premium put on them in the way that you did it in Georgia. Can you talk about the grassroots effort that people say really, really won it for you?
We call it the Team McKinney Street Heat. We actually, we walked about half of the district in the last 2 days. And we had been doing that for probably the last month. About a month out, we began walking the district. So we walked the district twice in about a month. And we were on street corners. We knocked on doors. We did phone banking. We did the kind of campaign that really people, I think, enjoy, because people enjoy being in contact with the supporters of a candidate, and they enjoy being in contact with the candidate. And, you know, you can wage this war over the airwaves, and it doesn't really penetrate and filter down. We had record turnout because I think we touched our voters so many times and in so many ways. And on this, I have to say a word of thanks to all of the organizations that were there. National Organization for Women had people on the ground walking those precincts with us. The Sierra Club was right there with us the entire way. The National AFL-CIO with their Labor 96 program, we had hundreds of people on the streets every day.
Congressman,
we couldn't have mobilized. to that extent without the progressive coalition being intact.
Congressmember McKinney, talking about the AFL, one of the things that they fiercely opposed this last term was President Clinton on NAFTA. Now, you supported President Clinton's push for NAFTA. You supported the North American Free Trade Agreement.
No, I did not.
Oh, you didn't?
I voted against it. In fact, the president invited me into the Oval Office in trying to persuade me to vote in support of NAFTA, but I stood firm.
Well, then let me ask you this. He
yes.
says now in the second term he's going to push for fast-track trade agreement approval in a number of areas. What are you going to do about that?
Well, I know the president has to take his position. I think what we will do is look at what he has to, what he negotiates very carefully. I don't necessarily agree with fast-track because I think we need to scrutinize carefully every line and iota of any trade agreement, because the bottom line is that my constituents are the ones who are going to be impacted, and I've got to make sure that my constituents aren't hurt.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, and Congressmember Cynthia McKinney will be watching you in Congress.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with the new party to talk about its future and then an interview with former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders as President Clinton chooses his new cabinet and many of those members leave. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The New Party is an alternative political party that's been successful in getting many progressive candidates elected to school boards, city councils, county boards, mayoralties, and state assemblies in the United States. The New Party is a truly grassroots, bottom-up organization intent on building a long-term organization and will soon be running people for Congress. We're now joined by Dan Cantor from Ann Arbor, Michigan, executive director of the New Party. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, what happened during this last election? How did the New Party candidates fare?
Well, in our races, we did fine. We only had a few dozen people running, and we won about two-thirds of those. We're not unaware of what happened in the broader election, so it was a predictable and predictably depressing day for us, even as we did well in the few dozen races we ran. So we think, Congressman McKinney, people like Wellstone, they show at least one of the ways forward, and the work that new party chapters are doing at the local level is a good part of that. But we clearly have our work cut out for us.
So what are your plans right now?
Well, there's a couple of things that need to happen in American politics. We have both organizational problems and we have ideological problems, and the new party is in part an effort to do something about both of those. We'd like to provide a way for progressives and their allies to gather their strength electorally and broadcast our values and issues in the public arena. And we'd also like to be organizationally competent in the way that the Christian Coalition is competent. That means recruiting and training our own people to run for office, developing programs that they can run and then govern on, and building a strong enough base to both support them when they're in office and hold them accountable. We can't demand accountability without providing support up. And so we're very much in favor of a mobilized, educated citizenry that can hold people's feet to the fire.
You know, I've noticed you mentioned the Christian Coalition as a model in terms of organizing. You didn't mention the Green Party. What is your assessment of Ralph Nader's run for president in terms of organizing the Green Party ticket?
Well, I assume it's not too different than your own in that it didn't make much of an impact. I have seen very little reporting on it after the facts. I don't even know what the vote totals were. But, you know, we have to be serious here, and it appears, I think it's definitive, but I suppose some people might argue differently, you can't build a progressive force in America by running for president. You have to be patient. You have to acknowledge that it has taken the left a long time to get as weak as it is, and it's going to take us some time to get our strength back. The bright light in all of this, obviously, is the revival of the labor movement politically. You know, the outcome wasn't what they wanted, but as someone said, this was a campaign against irrelevancy, and they certainly proved that they are not irrelevant. You know, the revival of labor is by far the most important political and institutional change that's happened in our lifetimes.
Well, what about that? What about not only AFL-CIO pouring all the money it did into ad campaigns altogether with organizing about $35 million, mm-hmm. but the Labor Party? How are you working with the Green Party and the Labor Party? Many have said, why can't they all come together?
Well, they have in some ways and in some places, functionally in a few states, prominently Wisconsin. It's more or less all one party, but people have different views. As you may know, the Labor Party doesn't want to engage in elections. So that's a fairly important strategic difference between the new party and the Labor Party.
But that's not for long term. I mean, ultimately, they say they do, but they want to get organized.
Right. And so when they do get organized, I imagine these things will all have to come together. You know, the real play here, of course, is weakness plus weakness is still weakness. And we're all small, and we all know it if we're being sober. What the new party has shown, I think, and what I'm hoping other minor parties show, is that it is in fact possible for progressives to speak to the center, as it were, with our values intact, if we are organizationally competent and willing to, you know, walk the long walk here.
What about labor money? I mean, this whole $35 million that's been so attacked, particularly by the Republicans, of course, because they were the target of the ads. But do you think this has set back efforts for campaign finance reform?
Set back because they
In the sense that since they have embraced it, they're very much working within the system. And, of course, we just had them on a few days ago, and they said, well, once the system is the way it is, we're going to fight like hell within that system.
Sure.
But in terms of the efforts now for campaign finance reform, do you think labor is going to be fully behind it? And what is the new party's stance?
Well, we are, you know, we think there's nothing more important in terms of reform of the electoral process, except perhaps for proportional representation, than campaign finance reform. So we worked on it this time around. Our people in Arkansas won a very important ballot measure, 2-1. They won a very strong campaign finance reform measure that will really help grassroots candidates. And at the national level, you know, there is going to be some campaign finance reform. Obviously, corporations will have more power in dictating the outlines of that reform than the trade union movement. Labor will fight like mad to make sure that they are not defanged while rich people are allowed to participate. And I think they have enough power probably to make sure that that doesn't happen. But obviously, you know, the whole system is completely corrupted. And one of the reasons the Democratic Party is so corrupted is, you know, it gets its votes from one place and its money from another. And this causes a disjunction. It was not inconsistent for people to vote for Bill Clinton on the one hand and a Republican congressman on the other. They really did resemble each other to a large degree. So the campaign finance thing only amplifies that problem. And if we get something decent, which is hard to believe, I mean, we should be serious here, right? The chances of this Congress and this president signing good, you know, campaign public financing of elections is zero. But they still may do something that that helps, just because they're aware of how disgusted the population is by this stuff.
Do you have any sense that Democrats are aware of this movement that is to the left of them, from President Clinton on down? And do you think ultimately in the next election that Democrats will be able to feel this pressure from the left in the same way that they responded to the pressure
mm-hmm.
from the right?
That's the million-dollar question. I don't know that the president's aware. Obviously, the party is deeply aware of efforts like the New Party, as well as other efforts inside the Democratic Party to pull them in a progressive direction. And, of course, what Gore and company will try to do between now and 2000 is prevent a challenge from the left. Our view in the new party is it's not going to matter if all we do is make a challenge in presidential primaries. Between now and then, we have all the term limit elections in 98 and 2000, tens of thousands of municipal elections and school board elections. We need to practice. We need to develop our confidence and our competence at the local level and move on up.
Dan Cantor, can you give us the number of the new party headquarters?
Sure, 1-800-200-1294.
One more time?
1-800-200-1294.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Dan Cantor, the executive director of the New Party.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! You know now that President Clinton is moving into his second term, and there have been a lot of announcements of cabinet members that are going to be leaving. Warren Christopher will be leaving. War Secretary William Perry is going to be leaving. And there's some suggestion that John Deutsch, who is now head of the CIA, will move over to be head of the Pentagon. We also have word that Robert Reich is going to be leaving his position as head of the Labor Department. He has an op-ed piece in today's New York Times called My Family Leave Policy, talking about spending more time with his kids. Well, we're going to talk about a controversial top appointment that Clinton made during his first term, Joycelyn Elders, the Surgeon General of the United States in the Clinton administration, before she was unceremoniously dumped for her comments about teaching masturbation as a form of safe sex to prevent AIDS. She came under fire for her many controversial positions on abortion, sex education, condom distribution, and the legalization of drugs. Her passion and outspokenness enraged Republicans and often upset the Clinton administration. Well, she's just written an autobiography called Joycelyn Elders, From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. And in it, she documents her rise. I mean, she was a first in so many ways. She graduated from the University of Arkansas Medical School and then became its first black resident, its first black chief resident, and finally its first black professor. And, of course, you know that she became the first black woman Surgeon General of the United States. I talked to her recently and first asked her to go back, before we talk about all the controversies of her time and what that says about the Clinton administration, to go back and talk about where she came from.
Well, I was the oldest of 8 children. My parents were very poor. I had two sets of grandparents, 13 aunts and uncles on one side, 17 on the other. So I had loads of extended family. We did not have running water. We did not have electricity. We did not have indoor plumbing. So we lived in poverty stricken. I went to a one-room school where they had 6 grades in one room. My mom really worked very hard with me, and I could read, write, and know my numbers before I started school. And I was started school when I was only 4. And I really felt like all of my sisters and brothers always worked very hard. We had some illness in our family. I remember my younger brother who had appendicitis, and his abdomen swelled up. He was extremely ill, and my dad took him to a doctor on the back of a mule, if you can imagine having appendicitis, and riding a mule for 10 miles. And the doctor put in a drain and let out the pus and sent him home because there was no hospitals available for black children. When we received major injuries, we put coal oil, C-O-A-L oil, that you often use in your kerosene lamps now during storms, but you use them during storms and think that's terrible. That was the only light that we had. We had wood-burning fireplaces. I know everybody thinks that's wonderful and is a novelty, but when that's your only means of heat in a raggedy house where it rains inside the house, you have no windows. In the summer, mosquitoes are everywhere. You have not even fans, because if you don't have electricity, you can't have fans. So we lived in very poverty-stricken conditions.
So how is it that you ended up going to college and then to medical school?
When I graduated from high school, the United Methodist Women gave a scholarship to the valedictorian of the class, and I happened to be the valedictorian of the class, to go to a United Methodist school, Philander Smith College, in Little Rock, Arkansas. And that was how I got my first step up, or found out that life existed different from the way that I lived. The other thing is that was my first time of ever seeing a doctor. And people have often asked me, well, did I always grow up and want to be the Surgeon General? My response to them is, you can't be what you can't see. So if you've never seen a doctor, you certainly can't grow up wanting to be the Surgeon General. And I met the first black woman to graduate from the University of Arkansas. She was in medical school when I was in college, and she came and gave a talk at our college. And from the moment she gave that talk, I always wanted to be just like her. So she was kind of my mentor or role model, even though we had never had, at that time, a separate or private conversation. And after I finished medical school, in fact, when I finished college, there was no money for me to think about going to college or going on to medical school. And I had to use the GI Bill. I went into service so I could use the GI Bill to go to medical school. And I just happened to be walking by and saw in the window the Army advertising for young women who had finished college who would join the Army, be commissioned as an officer in the Army, and they would send you to school and train you. Well, that's what happened. And then after I finished my training, I served 2 years in the Army as a physical therapist. I got out, and I had 36 months of schooling on the GI Bill, and I used that to go to medical school.
If it had been 10 years before, you wouldn't have been allowed in medical school.
Oh, no, absolutely not. They did not allow black students to attend the University of Arkansas. There were only two places that black students could go at that time, and that was Howard and Meharry. And, of course, they were really extremely competitive because that was the only place that black students could go. And you have to remember, this was in 1956, 57, during the time of the Central High Crisis, when we had the National Guard over there keeping the Little Rock Nine in Central High School.
Talk about that. Here you had these students who were right there as you were going to school trying to get into an all-white school.
Yes.
With the governor fighting them every step of the way.
The reason why they chose to integrate Central High School is because they thought that Little Rock, Arkansas was moderate, and this would be the one place that they could do it the easiest. And it was thought that we had a moderate governor, so it was thought that it could be done. Well, it was people coming out of the walls from all over the country, coming in, riling up people to say that to create the problem. And of course, Arkansas and Little Rock got a black eye that lasted forever. But we may have gotten something good out of it, because I really do think race relations in Little Rock, we had to fight through it, we had to deal with it. And none of us felt that it was as bad as this looked to be.
Were you aware of Thurgood Marshall at the time, who wasn't a Supreme Court justice yet but was arguing the case?
Yes.
Well, the kids?
Obviously, because of that, in Little Rock, we knew who I didn't know him personally, but we knew who Mr. Thurgood Marshall was, and we had the utmost respect for him and just thought that he was really our star, that somehow he'd fight it through and get it right. And, of course, I guess now that's one of the things that make me so sad about the fact that we have a Clarence Thomas replacing a Thurgood Marshall.
We're talking to Dr. Joycelyn Elders, and she has written her autobiography called Joycelyn Elders, M.D., From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. Well, it was after you were professor that you first came in contact with Governor Bill Clinton.
Yes.
With your appointment to become head of the Health Department of Arkansas.
Yes.
Tell us about your first meeting with him.
Well, I had really met him before, even when he was the Attorney General for the state of Arkansas, but it was just a kind of a chance meeting, but he asked me to serve on a commission, and I served that. But then when he asked me to be health director, he called me in the middle of the night and asked if I would consider it. And well, I wasn't thinking about being a health director. I was a professor of pediatric endocrinology. So I with, you know, you're kind of flip when you aren't very interested in a job and you don't care. So I told him something to the effect, I said, oh, you give me a 10% raise, I keep my tenured appointment, and let me run the health department, I'll consider it. Well, you know, I forgot about it because I really didn't expect to do that. Well, about 3 weeks later, he calls me back at 11 o'clock at night. Everybody who knows me knows I'm going to be at very early. And I wake up out of this deep sleep, and he said, Joycelyn, Bill Clinton. I said, oh, yes, sir. And he says, I got it all done. Will you take it? I said, I told you I would, didn't I? He said, yes, you did. I said, well, I don't want to lie. He said, thank you, bye. So that was how I became the health director for the state of Arkansas.
Now, you told that story accurately,
yes.
All except for one thing.
What?
He didn't call you Joycelyn.
No.
Doesn't he call you Jocelyn?
He calls me Jocelyn. Yes, he does. And as I tell everybody, I tried to train him differently for 6 years, and it never worked. So the President of the United States can call me Jocelyn. That's just fine.
Former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders will be back with her in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Dr. Joycelyn Elders, tell us about that conversation you had with President Clinton when he called you to be his Surgeon General.
Well, he called me and asked me if I would come by the mansion. You know, he had been elected president, but he was over at the governor's mansion. And so he asked me if I would come by after work. And I told him, yes, that I would. And I stopped by and he told me he thought about it, and he would like to name me as Surgeon General. Well, there had been a lot of talk around, and a lot of even in the news, and I'd gotten calls even from the then Secretary of Health about my being Secretary of Health,
and Louis so, Sullivan under Bush.
Yes. So you know, and so when he asked me to be, was talking to me about being the Surgeon General. You know, I have to admit, I was a little bit disappointed. And I said something to him. I said, Mr. President, I've already got a better job than that. But the thing that, and I said, but, you know, I told him, and I also told him, let me think about it. I said, but Governor, he was still Governor then. He hadn't been sworn in, I don't think. I said, Governor, I said, you didn't know what you was getting when you asked me to be your health director. I said, but you know what you're getting now. And he said, yes, I do. I want you to do for the nation what you've done for Arkansas.
Tell us about what it is that he was getting as Surgeon General. I mean, you had really transformed in yourself as well. How did you bring down the teenage pregnancy rate in Arkansas?
Well, we really got very busy involving the entire community. We had school-based clinics. We put in 28 new school-based clinics. We had our TV station gave all of its PSAs to talk about teenage pregnancy. So we involved the AARP, we involved our churches, and our public health nurses was very out there really working with schools. You know, they were well known by their schools, well respected by their superintendents.
And did you give out condoms in the schools?
We gave out condoms in the schools, but it was the school board could vote and decide whether they wanted contraceptives distributed or not.
So this is what President Clinton was getting. And also, you were a part of the health care reform task forces.
Yes.
And one of the things I was impressed by in your book, in your autobiography, was that you wrote that actually under President Bush, that it seemed that the task forces on health care reform, while not as heralded, were actually a lot more organized, bipartisan, and
yes.
a more serious effort was being made.
Yes. Well, but that had been going on for 3 to 4 years, that they had really been working hard looking at this effort. But you see, what happened, we ended up, you know, in the politics, we wanted a Democrat plan and a Republican plan, and, you know, everybody was fighting for their plan, and when we really should have gone and, you know, and worked together to put together our health plan for America. Nobody would remember our care, whether it was Democrat, Republican, single payer, the Cooper plan, or whatever the plan was. What they wanted was a health care system.
And they didn't get it.
And they didn't get it.
You say you ultimately felt that single payer is the way to go.
I feel that single payer is certainly a way to go. It guarantees that everyone has access to health care. I think America will have to rethink how they receive health care. And I think that was a major problem.
So why wouldn't Hillary Clinton even consider single payer?
Well, I think America was not ready for single payer. Our people, you see, 64% of our people have private insurance through their work. About 20 or 30% of our people are on Medicare and Medicaid. So we're talking about revamping our entire health system for 14% of our people that were not covered.
Except even with those people that are covered, I mean, the insurance rates are incredible. And it seemed that Hillary Clinton, Ira Magazine, or ultimately the president, was not willing to let go of the insurance industry as the middleman. And that's what cost the money.
Well, you know, that may have been. I'm not absolutely sure about that. But, you know, you've got to have a buy-in from the insurance companies, from the pharmaceutical agencies, from the hospitalizations, from the doctors. And we didn't have that buy-in from any of those people.
Well, let's talk a little about the controversies that you got into as Surgeon General, not knowing that you would get into it before you did. Talk about each of the sort of turning points where you got more attention than you thought you would.
Yes. Well, you know, I thought I got a lot more attention than I thought I would during my confirmation about things that I felt had very little to do with being a Surgeon General.
The Christian Coalition had been organizing against you already in Arkansas
yes.
because of your pro-choice stance and because
Absolutely.
Of your pushing, feeling that condoms should be available in
yes.
the schools.
Well, you know, of course, they're against all contraceptives. They feel that you shouldn't have health education in schools. They feel that all you need to do is just tell them don't do it, and that will fix it.
Then there was the drug war and the
yes.
question you were asked at the National Press Club about drug legalization.
Yes. Did I feel that drugs would reduce crime? And every study that's ever been done has said if we decriminalize drugs, it would reduce crime. And I said, I don't know all of the implications of legalization, but I feel that it should be studied.
And what happened after that?
Well, of course, I thought that I'd blown the top off Washington. You know, all of a sudden, it just really became just a real war, and I didn't even realize a war was breaking out. So I guess I'm telling you about my insensitivity, but I was called in. You know, we had a Surgeon General recommends legalization. Well, you know, I had never recommended. I felt that anything, that if you don't know what you're doing and you don't know how to do it, you need to study it and find out what the best options are.
You certainly got hit personally hard on this one. Can you talk about your son, Kevin, and what happened after these statements?
Yes. Well, of course, Kevin was a warrant was issued for his arrest for selling his friend three grams of cocaine. This had happened on July the 29th. They did not issue this warrant till December the 21st.
When did you make the comments?
Probably December the 20th or, you know, 16, you know, just a few days before that. So I obviously had some real, I didn't question about that, but I didn't think too much about it until, you know, as it was going on later. And, you know, Kevin was not the person really that had been implicated. They did not go after the person that this young man had implicated. And, of course, he killed himself. The young man that set
Kevin
up committed suicide 9 days later.
This is quite something what you write in your book, because that young man called you from a psychiatric institution.
Yes. He'd been under psychiatric therapy for more than 9 years. His psychiatrist called me. And then he, with the permission of the psychiatrist, he called me and they recorded it on tape, him begging me to find, get it, keep him from testifying. And he said, because if I don't, I said, well, talk to you, you know, your lawyer. He said, they told me if I didn't testify, they would kill me.
And who is it that he said would kill him? And who is it that he said?
Well, I guess he was talking about the police. Or, you know, or the lawyers, but this was what he was saying. I didn't, you know, I really didn't. And I did call my lawyer, talked to him about it. He said, Dr. Elders, I can't get in. He says, I'm not supposed to do that. He said, I can't get involved with that.
Didn't Calvin Walraven, the young man's name, didn't he also say that the police had paid him to get Kevin to sell him drugs?
Oh, yes. Well, that's a matter of fact. That's a matter of police record. But we didn't know that at the time. And the police, you know, it was not told. It was only when we appealed the case and it came out in federal court and they got the police records that they were able to document that the police had, in fact, paid Calvin Walraven.
Why?
To set Kevin up. Or to, no, well, to, you know, to, well, our, I don't know, to get himself off. I don't know why they paid him, you know, so I shouldn't say to set Kevin up, but they was paying him for as a police informant.
And as Calvin Walraven testified and apologized to you as he was leaving that testimony, he then killed himself a week later.
Yes.
And your son Kevin was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Yes.
Where is he today?
At home. Kevin was, we were very, very fortunate. Kevin was able to enter, Arkansas has a rule, a law, you know, a boot camp, that if this is your first offense, if it's less than 10 years, or 10 years or less, it did not involve a weapon, you know, it was not a violent crime, that you can go to a boot camp, and which is 105 days, following which you can really be discharged from the boot camp, but you're still obviously on probation.
Does Kevin feel bitter about what happened? Does he feel he was set up because of you as Surgeon General?
And I think Kevin feels that he was set up. But, you know, I mean, Kevin knows that he was using drugs. We found out that he was using drugs. We know that that was wrong, you know, that that was illegal. So, and I feel that probably because that happened, my son may be alive today.
Even though Calvin Walraven did lose his life.
That's right. You know, I feel that, you know, if Kevin got treatment, he's clean, he's doing well, he's working, his mother is proud, and I know that it's one day at a time, but he goes to AA 7 days a week, and I'm grateful for every day I get.
During that time, President Clinton did call you.
Yes. And he called me, and he said that he was, you know, he was sorry, and he told me about his brother, but, you know, I'm from Arkansas, and I knew about that, but I was grateful that he called me.
But that was probably one of the few times you ever talked to him again. Let's get to the next controversial time, which was really your last time as Surgeon General.
Yes.
And that was that fateful World AIDS Day when you were part of a panel talking about AIDS. Talk about the psychiatrist who asked you the question.
Well, the psychiatrist asked me a question whether I thought that masturbation might be an alternative to reducing HIV disease. We talked about the ABCD of AIDS prevention. Abstinence, be faithful, latex condoms, and do other things. And so we were talking about the masturbation issue. And he talked about he masturbated and said things. And I said, you know, we don't even teach our children the basics of health, sexuality education. But I feel that we need to educate our children about masturbation as a normal part of human sexuality. We need to teach them their hair won't grow on their palms, they won't go crazy, or they won't go blind. And, you know, as far as, and then it was publicized that I was recommending that we teach children how to masturbate. Well, everybody in the world knows nobody has to teach anybody how to masturbate. God taught us how to masturbate. So, you know, it really made no sense. I couldn't believe that sensible thinking, grown people would even talk about that. All they had to do was think about themselves.
And so you went back to work. And
I went back to work. I was there for, it was about 9 days later that, you know, all of a sudden I was called in to see the secretary, and I didn't know why. And, you know, she asked me if I said anything about masturbation when I was in New York at the UN.
This is Secretary Donna Shalala.
Yes.
Who you two, you never really got along.
Well, I won't say we didn't get along. You know, we just kind of moved in different circles and did different things. So, and I told her, well, yes, I probably did. And she said, well, I don't think we can save you now. I just think, you know, I thought, oh, my goodness, what in the world is this woman talking about? And she kept saying that, and so she said, well, here we got it on the tape, and you know that was you know that I was saying that we should teach children about masturbation as a part of a normal human sexuality course. But then, Mr. Panetta called me and told me he says that he wanted my resignation by 2:30.
Chief of staff.
And I told him I would not resign until I talked with the president. And so he told me that the president was in Florida and he didn't really have time and, you know, a few other things. And I told him, well, I won't resign. And so an hour later, the president calls me telling me that, well, Jocelyn, we can't have any more of this. And I'm just sorry. We just can't. I said, Mr. President, do you know what I said? He said, yes, they told me. I said, but hey, do you know exactly what I said? He said, I understand. They got it. They told me what you said. And he said, we just can't have any more of this. And I'm just sorry. If just get your resignation on Panetta's desk by 2:30. And so I just said, well, thank you, Mr. President. What else could I say?
Have you ever spoken to President Clinton again?
No.
Has he ever called you?
No.
What do you think about President Clinton today?
Well, I really support the president. You know, I still support President Clinton. I feel that if he, you know, if I was not doing what he wanted done in the job, you know, as Surgeon General, well, I feel that the president has to, you know, he should do what he did. You know, he should get someone who can do what he wants done as Surgeon General. I have no problem with that. And I'm back at Arkansas. I'm a professor. I'm speaking out. I'm writing. And so I'm okay.
What do you feel is your greatest accomplishment as Surgeon General?
Increasing the awareness of the American people of the problems of our adolescence. I think everybody in America who, you know, knows that I was fighting for adolescence, I was trying to reduce teenage pregnancy, reduce the spread of AIDS, to deal with violence and drug abuse. Everybody in America, if you just meet them on the street and ask them if they know me, I think they would probably talk about teenage pregnancy first.
And what are your thoughts, talking about drug abuse, about the latest revelations of the San Jose Mercury News, about how the CIA was involved with bringing drugs into this country and ultimately funneling them, particularly into the black community in Los Angeles?
You know, I've heard the news reports and I've heard that. I haven't let myself believe that yet. I can't believe that our government would do something like that to our people. And if they will, and if they did, then we're much worse off than I ever thought we were.
Henry Foster, your thoughts as he went through, we were there, Pacifica, covering
yes.
the hearings. What were your thoughts as he went through, basically dealing with what you left off, Henry Foster, who ultimately did not become Surgeon General because he was pro-choice and because
yes.
he himself had performed abortions?
Yes. You know, it was very painful for me. You see, Henry Foster was 2 years ahead of me in medical school, and so I'd known him for a very long time. He would have been an excellent Surgeon General, and I have the utmost respect for Dr. Foster. And I, as I have told someone earlier today, at the time that he was probably going through his confirmation, only God and the Pope would have probably gotten through a confirmation hearing, and I'm not sure about the Pope.
Dr. Jocelyn Elders, her book is Jocelyn Elders, MD, From Sharecropper's Daughter to Surgeon General of the United States of America. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
You can't come in, I hear you knocking. You can't come in, I hear you knocking. You can't come in, cause I'm firing the Surgeon General.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Dave Rabin. Our engineer is Errol Maitland. Our director, Brother Shine. Thanks to Zachary Fink. I'm Amy Goodman for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
I used to hog the dolphin, used to choke the chicken, used to spank the monkey, used to fool.